News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, featuring unique shopping and the historic Jack's Cafe featuring an eclectic menu. A Kenosha tradition since 1911, modernized for a new age. Visit jackandrea.com for more information. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we hear about the Racine County Food Bank and their big, big fundraiser coming up this weekend. In part two, out of the Morning Show archives, the inspiring story of a blind man who climbed the summit of Mount Everest and kayaked the Colorado River. Stay with us. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be spending a few minutes of today's morning show talking about the important work of the Racine County Food Bank. And we're going to be talking about their biggest fundraiser of the year. I assume it is their biggest fundraiser. It's certainly a well-known event, Thoughts for Food, which is going to be coming up on March 6th and 7th. An enormous event that involves a small army of dedicated volunteers, as well as dozens and dozens of area bands who volunteer to be part of this wonderful event. A two-night event, actually. The first night, an all-ages event designed to be appropriate for people young and old alike, but especially for young people, and then kind of the main event, which is on Saturday, the 7th. So we have two people very deeply involved in this event who are joining us today. Ruth Thielen is one of the principal organizers of Thoughts for Food, Connie Kirchner as well. And Connie Kirchner is a board member for the Racine County Food Bank. And also, as a musician, she has actually performed at this event any number of times. So they both have their roots embedded deeply into this event and to the very worthy cause which it supports. Ruth Thielen, Connie Kirchner, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Greg.
Good to have you here. I'd like to begin with some background for our listeners about the Racine County Food Bank. And Connie, maybe you could give us, first of all, kind of a historical sense of just how long the Racine County Food Bank has been in existence, and we can explore maybe a little more about how it functions and how it does its good work.
Okay, thank you. The food bank's been in existence since about 1983. It was Project Emergency in the beginning. In fact, one of the founders of Thoughts for Food was the first executive director, Mark Paffrath.
Oh, so yes.
Kind of a nice connection there. Mm-hmm. Fighting hunger in Racine has been something we've struggled with for years, and the Racine County Food Bank is a great network. We have good guidelines set in place, and we serve about 13 pantries. We're the hub that brings food into about 13 pantries in Racine County. It's a very well-oiled machine. I've been on the board for about 10 years. So
you know it inside out.
Pretty much.
So you are kind of a central gathering point for food, and then you help disperse it to the various food pantries that actually disperse it to people.
Correct.
So not much in the way of people actually come to the Racine County Food Bank in terms of people who need food. You are helping to facilitate that outreach in various food pantries around the city.
We're a warehouse, and there's four employees at the Racine County Food Bank who disperse the food in big refrigerated trucks to all the pantries in Racine. So,
where does the food, by and large, come from?
Well, there's two big donations every year. One of them is Thoughts for Food. There's a non-perishable item that's required, one or two to come in. Many people bring a whole bag. We do a big Boy Scout fundraiser where their post office does the pickup. And then that's all picked up and distributed into the pantry. And actually volunteers come in and sort the food in the warehouse. And that is a big push every year for it. And then with the monies raised, we can buy quantities at a good price to put on the shelves in the pantry. So with the money we use, we buy product. And with the collections through the city, we fill the pantries.
Wow. What have you primarily been involved in as a member of the board over the last decade? What kinds of responsibilities have you had, or what aspects of this have you been most involved in?
Well, I've always been passionate about nobody should go hungry. There's no reason for that. So actually Thoughts for Food was how I got involved with the food bank, and meeting up with Dan and my cousin Steve Klinkhammer, who was a founder. He said, you know, Connie, you should be on the board. You'd be a good fit. So, again, that was 10 years ago, and I've done some of the big fundraisers. I've been involved with Thoughts for Food for the past 25 years. And the Boy Scouts drive at the Sturtevant Post Office. You just stay there all day and fill the truck and then bring it back to the pantry. So if there's a need out there, I'm usually trying to be involved in it.
Very good. Yep. Does the Racine County Food Bank operate under the auspices or oversight of any kind of larger organization or agency, or is it a freestanding
organization? United Way is one of our big funders, and you know, we fill out the application every year for them, and they are a great financial part of us.
Very good. Yep. I remember having more than one morning show conversation way back when with Mark Paffrath talking about this when it was named Project Emergency.
Right.
And, of course, although it doesn't bear that name anymore, that name says a lot in terms of how urgent this need is. I mean, it doesn't get any more fundamental than making sure that people have food to eat. So.
That's correct.
How many people comprise the board?
Let's see. We have an executive director. We have president, vice president, secretary, treasurer, and about 9 board members.
Very good. Mm-hmm. And so your involvement actually began for you as a musician performing in Thoughts for Food?
It did. So
tell us about that first time you were part of this event. I mean, what band were you a part of? And
well, I'm still part of the same band today, Menard Location, and Steve Klinkhammer, as I mentioned earlier, with Mark Paffrath, and I call him Hippie. What's his name?
Ron Johnson.
Ron Johnson. The three of them were the founders.
I'm sorry, Ron Schultz. I misspoke.
Okay, so he called me up on the stage, and because he was teaching me guitar, and that was my first live performance ever.
Wow.
So I kind of liked it, and I thought, all right, I can do this. So I've been in the band ever since.
Wow, very good.
Yep.
And will they be one of the bands performing this year?
We will be at George's Tavern from 7 to 9 p.m. on March 7th, Saturday.
Fantastic. So Ruth Thielen, I know you are anxious to tell us more about this big Thoughts for Food event coming up, which again is really the major fundraiser for the Racine County Food Bank. And I know you want to tell us a little bit about its really modest and interesting origins many, many years ago, 1993, I think.
Yes. Yes. So the event started in 1993, and I apologize, Hippie, for saying your name wrong. everyone knows him as Hippie, but Ron Schultz, Bill May, and Steve Klinkhammer, who were all Vietnam veterans from Vets 21, along with Dave Popoff, who's the owner of George's Tavern, and Mark Paffrath, who was Project Emergency. They just decided they had the concept for music. They kind of, at the beginning, it was like a beer party with music for food. That was sort of their thought. It was a reason to get together in March, and we can raise some money for the food bank. We can supply the pantry. We can get together and have some music. It was at George's Tavern. There was 3 bands. It was $3, and they had an event. And 28 years later, we have 18 stages this year. We have, I believe, 44 bands.
Wow.
And what's most amazing to me, I've been involved with the event for years, volunteering at the door at George's and enjoying it. And then the last 6 years I've been on the committee or co-chair of the committee along with Mike Boldus. And what blows my mind about this is that, you know, in a time we need to stock the food pantry in March like we do in November and December. And we could go to a corporate sponsor and ask for $15,000 or $20,000, but then you're relying on one company. This is a tremendous amount of volunteerism. It blows my mind every year that these bands will start submitting applications in December saying, please let me come and play for free so I can support the Racine County Food Bank.
Wow.
That's tremendous. It's really tremendous. And so we have bands, they're acoustic bands, they're 60s, 70s cover bands. We have a punk band with happy horror lyrics. We have a Rat Package tribute. We have such a variety of music at all of these different venues. We try to mix it up and allow everyone something to come and see at the event.
Fantastic. So explain for someone who has never attended, how does it work? I mean, you buy a ticket, but then what happens? Where do you go? How do you experience Thoughts for Food?
Exactly. Well, the first step I would recommend is that you buy an advance ticket, because tickets are $10 in advance until the Friday before the event. Then they become $15. So that $10 is going to give you a ticket. When you get to a door, you get a wristband, and that wristband lets you in all 18 venues all night long. We have three buses that run throughout the evening between all of the venues. Mm. Fifth Street Yacht Club is a part of the event, and they have a huge parking lot, so they offer people, hey, come start here. Park your car here, hop on the shuttle bus, and then for $10 and two non-perishable food items, you get to travel around from 7 until 2 a.m. listening to any kind of music that you want to hear. That's wow. What's fun about it. If you go in and like a band, you can sit. If you don't, you can travel on to the next venue. If you go on to the Thoughts for Food webpage, we have the schedule on there. And Mike Boldus, who does our webpage, has done a great job of linking up a lot of the bands with their material or website. So you can click on Sam's and Spitzer and say, hey, what kind of music is that? You can see them in their studio. So you get a taste for what kind of music it is. You can kind of plan out your night and see, what do I want to go see?
Wow. So what's involved in organizing this kind of event? I mean, what are, in a sense, like some of the choices and decisions and plans that have to be kind of laid out to make all this happen?
Well, we start out usually in September each year, really working for the event. The venues, we ask any venue that wants to be in to submit an application by November 1st, so that we have an idea, first of all, how many venues we have, because that really dictates a lot. We have to have sound at every venue, and that's our most difficult challenge. Some venues have their own sound systems. Most of them do not. So then we rely on the bands to, okay, who is willing to provide sound. The only money that changes hand in this event, the venues pay $300 to be in the event. That money goes back to the sound engineer, the bass, the drum line, the whole thing. So it really is an exchange of money. It's not going into the food bank. But so we have to coordinate all of that. Then, of course, there's a lot of organizing, promoting. We have someone who's in charge of corporate sponsors who goes out. You can do a sponsorship for $100, $300, $500 for your company, which gets you so many tickets, gets your name on all of our advertising, gets you a stage banner, those kind of things. So we have different people on the committee. Michael Gibson from George's Tavern is the one who's really herding all the cats. He's coordinating because he knows music. He coordinates this band will work well with that sound and this venue and that thing. He really puts those pieces together, and that's a tremendous amount of work.
I was going to say, I would think that some interesting choices get made in terms of which band should be where, that certain groups, certain sounds are going to work probably better in certain locales versus other locales.
Exactly. We have some smaller venues. Racine Brewing has been a part of the event for the last 2 years. And, you know, they have unique space and unique sound, so we have to find the right group that works there. You know, the venues, everybody wants the biggest draw, the most popular band. We can't always accommodate that. So we try to spread that out each year so that every venue does very well, but then also mix it up a little bit so that, you know, hey, you stay in here the next band, and that's not music I ever would have thought of going out to listen to, but they're really good. So that's kind of a taste of it, too, that it mixes up things a lot.
Interesting. So explain why a venue would want to be part of this. In what way is a venue benefited, besides just, in I'm sure many cases, wanting to support a good cause? But,
well, you know, truthfully, Greg, I think that's it. Wanting to support a good cause is a big part of it, because every venue that's in it, you know, they're just committed to the event. They're really, in even smaller venues, they're willing to hand over a check for $300 in December when times are tough, sometimes in the winter for venues, but they really believe in the event. The biggest draw is that, number one, you're going to get probably a bunch of people in your place that have never been to your place.
Right.
Longshot Vinyl downtown is fairly new. They're a very small venue. They want to be in it. They want the exposure. They want to support the event. They're going to get people in there that have never been there before. Same with Racine Brewing last year. Some of the newer venues. Marcy's on Main is in this year for the first time. Maxine's is back in after a year hiatus. Main Hub on North Main Street is a very small venue. It's hard to fit music in there, but they've been willing to participate for the last 2 years, only having one band, just because they know they're going to draw a lot of people in. A lot of these people like to drink beer.
There's that.
So you're going to get business over the bar. Obviously, you're going to, you know, sell a lot of product on a Saturday in March when it's cold, and you probably wouldn't normally have more than a few people in on a Saturday night at 10 o'clock.
Right.
So it's a draw to the downtown area, but it's also a huge support of the food bank. And it's a support of music, you know. When you think of the
live
size
music.
Of Racine, to have 43 or 44 live bands that are popping up to do this.
Wow.
We do have a couple bands from Kenosha. We have a band from Milwaukee this year that stepped up at the last minute to provide sound at the Rhino Bar because we had a cancellation. Starlight Riot is the name of the band from Milwaukee. So we have huge kudos to these bands that are willing to step in, provide sound, hang out for the night, and do their part to support the food bank.
Fantastic, fantastic. So do there end up being other people who are just sort of there anyway? I mean, like a normal customer at George's Tavern? Or in a sense, are these venues, at least to some extent, kind of restricted to people who are part of this Thoughts for Food?
Yeah. That is, starting at about 6:30 that night, you need to have a wristband to be in the venue.
Okay.
So that it can be a struggle at certain places that maybe normally serve food, like the Nash serves food. And so you might have people that are coming there on a Saturday night to eat with their family and then say, oh, wait, we have to pay to get in the door. So we try to get the word out on that a little bit earlier.
Sure, sure.
And obviously, Jody at the Nash, you know, we let people know ahead of time. And when they come in, we explain the event. And I have to be honest with you, the last couple of years when we've told people that, they said, you know what, we believe in the event. We're going to support it. So that's been huge for us to just really see that people really still want to support the event. And as I said, we try to get the word out ahead of time so people know that the event is going on. The bands that play, obviously, they're allowed free admission. The volunteers are allowed free admission, but I can't tell you how many of the volunteers write a check anyway.
Wow.
For the ticket, because they believe in it.
Mm, that says a lot, doesn't it?
It does.
Absolutely.
It really does.
So, Connie, I can't remember if you said this earlier, but where are you going to be performing on Saturday night?
So our five-piece band, Menard Location, will be at George's Tavern from 7 to 9 p.m. We get a two-hour slot this year, which is kind of nice because in the past there have been so many bands that you get like 45 minutes.
Mm.
And just a shout-out to my husband, Chuck Kirshner. He volunteered and did sound for our band for 20 years. He's recently retired from that, which is a little sad, but I just appreciate it. You know, all that he did.
That's really neat. Mm-hmm. That's great. Mm-hmm. I don't think we've yet talked about what happens the night before on Friday night. So that's Friday night, March 6th, the All Ages event. Explain how this is different from what happens Saturday night.
Okay. So the All Ages event on Friday night is more of a youth event. Nick Ramsey, who's also on the board with us,
yes,
who is a former Racine poet laureate and an organizer and a motivator and just one of the neatest people I've ever met.
Yep.
Nick goes out into all of the schools and finds musicians. Typically, we have 6 to 7 acts. This year, we have 13.
Wow.
And so from 5:30 to 10:30 on Friday night at the Eagles Club, it's $5 to get in with 2 non-perishable food items. And it's really designed to help the youth of our community, first of all, get together and support the food bank, but second of all, get together and network with other musicians they might not normally meet and get some diversity into our music scene. So this year, our event, we start out with, you know, the Pickle Bucket drummers. We've got several performers who are singers that just sing with backtracks. We've got performers who are songwriters that sing. Mm. We have a poet. We've got several rappers this year. We've got the Real School Jazz Band, which I have to give a huge shout out to Dan, the music teacher at the Real School, because he comes and provides the back line, the drum, the sound, everything. Each year, he's been a huge supporter of this event the last few years so that we have everything we need in the background. And then it's really neat because Nick gets these kids interacting. We have kids from Case, Park, Horlick, Real School, Walden, and he will get them together and get them networked so they start to know each other out in the music community. Some of these kids have one or two songs. Some of them have a whole set.
Sure.
But it might be their first time to really get up on stage and showcase their music.
Wow.
So then as a result, we've had some of these that have been, I mean, they've turned into bands. They have CDs. They have music out there. And then as they get older, they've performed in the All Ages event on Saturday.
Neat.
Which is neat to see the music scene in Racine evolve into that and still support the event.
So this is almost a seeding event in a couple of different ways. That's really exciting.
And their parents get to come and see them too.
It is exciting to see the parents come in and see parents of other kids going, holy cow, I had no idea we had musicians like that in this community.
And it gets on these young people's radar, this issue of hunger as well, that perhaps has not touched them directly, but that they need to be aware of. This is great. So the All Ages event, again, is on Friday evening, March 6th. And then the main event for Thoughts for Food is Saturday evening, March 7th and it's mostly in downtown Racine, but there's another neighborhood, I think, that's involved as well.
It starts the north end from, like, the Rhino Bar and Racine Yacht Club, and then it goes all the way down through Coasters and George's into downtown, and then a little bit outlier kind of Maxine's.
Mm-hmm.
And then it loops, as I said, the 5th Street Yacht Club, which, if you're looking for parking, is a great place to go.
Right, and there's buses or shuttles that can get you from venue to venue in very efficient fashion. So where can people purchase tickets ahead of time, which, again, for the next few days are just $10 a piece?
Correct. You can purchase tickets online at the Thoughts for Food website. We have a ticket outlet there where you can do it directly. Otherwise, many of our venues are selling advanced tickets, and so we'd encourage you to go stop in there, have a beer, support them for supporting the event, and buy the ticket. And those that are selling tickets are Harbor Light Yacht Club, the Racine Yacht Club, the 5th Street Yacht Club, George's Tavern, which is kind of the main headquarters and founding spot as well. Coasters is selling tickets. Longshot Vinyl is selling tickets. Racine Brewing is selling tickets. Marcy's on Main is selling tickets. Pub on Wisconsin is selling tickets. And I do want to mention this. All of the venues that are selling tickets, we have a bartender contest. We've tried to drum up sales, advance sales. So the bartender that sells the most tickets to the event gets a weekend package to a water park in the Dells, along with some Cujos out there. And we also have a random drawing. So for every ticket a bartender sells, they get a random ticket into a drawing for the second prize.
Wow.
So go support your local bartender.
That's
give them a chance.
Great.
They're wearing buttons that say, "Want to send me away?"
Okay.
So that by supporting them, you're also supporting the event.
Fantastic. And it's nice incentive for bartenders who often have a very close relationship with their frequent customers to bang the drum for this really, really great event. Again, it's coming up, Friday night, the All Ages event, mostly for young people, and then the Saturday main event for Thoughts for Food in Racine. And then you can go to the Thoughts for Food website just by Googling it. I suppose it's easy to find to get more information on the various venues that are involved and where you can purchase tickets.
One last thing, Gregory, I want to mention. We're going to be airing this on Monday. As you said, Monday is the Empty Bowls event in Racine as well, which takes place down at Festival Hall. And you can go to the Empty Bowls website as well. But that is another huge supporter of the Racine County Food Bank. They serve over lunch and they serve over dinner. Over 25 venues in Racine have donated soup for that event. A lot of community organizers and politicians serve you the soup at that event.
So 11 a.m. to 7 p.m.
It's incredible. I went last year for the first time, and I had to miss in several years, and I couldn't believe how much the event had grown in just the few years that I'd missed it. I was really dazzled by the array of soup and those wonderful bowls that have been created.
Right. All the kids in the schools make all those bowls and then donate them. I think that's amazing.
Yeah,
now
I'm so glad you
want to go to the event because they want to pick their own bowl.
Oh, there you go. So I'm glad you mentioned that. Empty Bowls at Festival Hall in downtown Racine all day on Monday. And then, of course, Thoughts for Food coming up on Friday and Saturday. Ruth Thielen and Connie Kirchner, I really appreciate you being here and so capably and enthusiastically spreading the word about this really great event. It was wonderful to have you on the morning show, and I thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's program is from the Morning Show archives and an interview originally recorded and aired in 2018. I am very excited to be speaking with a real-life hero today on the morning show. His name is Eric Weihenmayer, and I'm sure many of you know his name, and with good reason. Eric Weihenmayer has been to the summit of Mount Everest, and it so happens that he is the first and still only blind person to ever reach that summit. Not only that, he has climbed the highest peaks of all seven continents. He has led a group of blind young Tibetans 21,000 feet up the face of Mount Everest and accomplished a whole lot of other things. In fact, some people would say teaching middle school for 6 years was probably an accomplishment roughly akin to scaling Mount Everest. His most recent adventure involved kayaking the entire 277 miles of the Grand Canyon on the Colorado River. Dangerous for anybody. And it is an accomplishment made, in a sense, at great cost and at great peril. And the story is told in a really great book called No Barriers, A Blind Man's Journey to Kayak the Grand Canyon. And No Barriers, the title of the book, also refers to an exciting program which Eric Weihenmayer helped create, which helps to create exciting and life-transforming opportunities for people who are contending with various challenges and limitations of one kind or another. The book, again, No Barriers, is published by Thomas Dunn. And Eric Weihenmayer, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much.
I'm really excited to talk with you. I should mention your previous books are Touch the Top of the World and The Adversity Advantage. You spend a fair amount of this book, and I'm glad you do, sort of setting the stage in part by talking about your own blindness. Explain briefly to our listeners when it was that you went entirely blind and what that experience was like, particularly in the moment.
Yeah, I write about, it was like winning the lottery, but the opposite. So I had this missing some genes. So nobody in my family had ever been blind or anything, but I was born visually impaired. I could see a little bit until middle school when I started losing a lot of sight. And a week before my freshman year in high school, I was totally blind. I remember being led into school that first day and thinking, I can't literally see to take a step.
Right. If I can just jump in, you tell a really cool story about watching an inspiring story on television in those last days before your blindness became complete. Tell us about the real-life figure you watched on television and the kind of inspiration that he was for you in that difficult moment.
So I was in a dark place. I could still see a little bit out of one eye just for a couple more months. So I'd watch TV with my nose right up against the screen, and I watched this guy named Terry Fox. He was a phenomenon. I mean, he was a Canadian. He lost a leg to cancer, and then he made this decision, which was like the craziest decision. He decided he was going to run across Canada, thousands of miles, and I thought, you're not supposed to react that way. You know, that's you're supposed to shrink. You're supposed to kind of curl up in a ball and just protect the little bit you have left. You know, that's what happens when, you know, that when tragedy strikes. But he didn't know that. He got bigger and he converted that darkness into something else, and he used it as energy, and he used it to propel himself forward. And, you know, Terry Fox is a hero of mine and a huge Canadian legend. And it was all based on one decision. And that really set up the message of the book and my exploration over the last 16 years trying to understand what no barriers means. Like, these counterintuitive ways that people react to these situations. They get shattered, and instead of getting smaller, they get bigger. And it's a part of that map that I think is important.
Absolutely. Back to the first days of your blindness, just for a moment. One of the most poignant things you describe in that, as you began school as a ninth grader, newly blind, completely blind, that is, although, as you said, you'd contended with vision limitations all of your life, but you describe, if I remember correctly, sitting in the cafeteria of that school and hearing kind of all the chaos and fun all around you, including a food fight erupting at one point. And of course, you are not a part of any of this. And just the thought that you'll never be in a food fight, in a sense, was a moment in which the reality of this began to really sink in. And I just think that's so interesting how, for particularly a young person of that age, it would be something like that that would make you feel the most like you were on the outside looking in, so to speak.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so sitting in that cafeteria seat by myself at my own table, all my friends were a couple tables away in the middle of that food fight, laughing and joking. And I remember thinking, like, yeah, it's scary to go blind, not be able to see, but the real fear was being swept to the sidelines and listening to your life go by and feeling these sort of prison bars, you know, fall down around your mind and not knowing how to get out of that and how to break through that brick wall between, right, you know, get me back to the world. And
even if it's an ordinary life, I think that's why that leapt out at me in your book, because, you know, your book is mostly about scaling Mount Everest and then riding the rapids of the Colorado River. In this painful moment, you're not thinking about any of that. You just want to be able to access something as normal as a food fight in your high school's gymnasium or cafeteria. One of the things you do to try to sort of forge a path towards a normal full life is that you join your school's wrestling team. And this ends up being a really important part of your life. Just explain how successful you ultimately were able to be after some struggles in the early going.
Yeah, I stunk my first few years, but I got better. And it was the greatest decision I could have made, because it was my first experience being a part of something great, you know. And I think people crave to be part of things, you know, especially when you're blind and or you have some challenge and you feel isolated. So, yeah, I worked my way up to captain and represented our state and nationals. And, I turned out to be a good wrestler, but it was a lot of work, and it was a hard road.
Right. And I should think that being blind and wrestling, I mean, you were operating with a really acute disadvantage and probably had to bring all of your other skills up to the highest possible level in order to be a worthy competitor, which you turned out to be.
Yeah, it's not that much different from climbing, really, because, you know, I'm making predictions. I can't see the person's leg, but I feel their, like, wrist, and that gives me a clue where their leg might be, you know, by their body position. And climbing's the same way. You know, you can't see the rock, but you are feeling up the rock using your hands and your feet as your eyes, and you're sort of making predictions about where that next hold might be in the rock. And so, yeah, when you're blind, you're doing a lot of sort of mapping in your brain.
Well, ultimately, you are able to go on from those successes to completing college and to getting a job teaching middle school. And, of course, that was no small matter either, in that there are all kinds of principals and superintendents who are not willing to give a blind teacher a chance in a sighted environment, in a classroom of sighted students. But someone took a chance, and you ended up being a very successful and happy teacher. What was it that prompted you to leave that kind of adventure for the kind of adventures that have dominated your life since, including the scaling of Mount Everest? What sort of hunger prompted that dramatic move?
Well, I was a teacher for 6 years, and I loved it. I could have done it forever. I loved that part of my life. And I'd been climbing, though. I'd been a what you call a weekend warrior, which is like you're climbing hard on the weekends. And I started climbing bigger mountains, and I realized I couldn't do both. I couldn't teach. I wanted to make a life in the mountains. And so in 1997, I left teaching, and I tried to make my life as a blind adventurer, which there's not too many countries in the world where you can become a professional blind climber. It's not too many venture capitalist funds would have invested in that idea. But the last 20 years, that's what I've been doing. And I love it, you know, climbing around the world. I read a book called The Seven Summits by this guy named Dick Bass. And he made the Seven Summits famous. And I thought, how incredible to go around the world, every continent, experiencing these great adventures with a great team.
You ultimately, of course, managed to score this extraordinary success of scaling the summit of Mount Everest. That was back in 2001. And, of course, in one of your previous books, we can hear all about that. Part of what is important for us to know in terms of your more recent adventure is something that somebody said to you as you were finishing your descent off of Mount Everest, words that you were not expecting this colleague to say to you, and words that really made a difference. Tell our listeners what was said to you and what kind of difference that made.
You come down from Everest, and you know, people are like, oh, you shattered the world's expectations. And it's like, well, first of all, I shattered my own, because there wasn't 100% certainty that I was going to stand up there at 29,000 feet. You know, so many things came together, a great team and lots of preparation and weather. Came down the mountain and got down below it where it was the safer zone and I knew I was going to live. And PV, our team leader, brought me aside and he said, you know, don't make this the greatest thing you ever do. And I thought, yeah, that was really bad timing because you're just really crushed physically and mentally. And I thought, no, let me go home and celebrate for the next 50 years. But what he was saying was, you know, these successes that we've all had, whatever they may be, you know, don't make them a funeral. Make them the launching point to more great adventure. You know, use that as a way to propel yourself towards new sort of surprising paths.
One of those that you ended up undertaking that proved to be an extraordinary experience was to return to Mount Everest with a group of blind Tibetans, young Tibetans, and taking, in a sense, then someone else on this amazing kind of journey. And it proved to be an incredible adventure, but also not easy in any way. And I so appreciate that you describe this expedition as honestly and frankly as you do, because as you say in the book, all of the complexity and difficulties really, in a sense, represented the way life so often can be, particularly for people who are faced with exceptional challenges.
Yeah, I'd gotten off this huge successful climb with Everest. You know, they called us one of the greatest teams that ever were on the mountain. And so I had this preconception now that all teams were like that. And I built this great team of Tibetan kids that were shunned by their society. You know, people spit on them in the street. And I thought, let's do something where their villages, their families never would dream of, and let's help these kids get this really bigness inside them, and it'll affect the trajectory of their lives. And it turns out that we struggled on that trip. You know, we had a film crew, we had the Tibetan kids, we had their teacher, Sabria, who was a beautiful lady from Germany who was blind, who ran the school, and she was worried about the kids. And we had Sherpas, who are the local people on Everest, and then, they're descendants of the Tibetans, but they're different, so everyone's fighting. And so off the heels of this amazing success, I have this team that's in absolute turmoil with cultural barriers and language barriers and age barriers. And ultimately, we wound up finding something meaningful, which is something you have to do a lot of times in these more typical teams. You have to find the win and the meaning for everyone. But it took a lot to get there.
One of your best lines, I think, as you are describing all of this, is something to the effect that democracy does not work on the mountain. that it's often a situation in which you simply can't have committee meetings and long involved discussions to decide what's going to happen. So.
No, as the avalanche is pouring down the mountain, you don't have time to debate sometimes. So you elect a leader. You don't even elect a leader. You know, you just somebody has to be trusted to be that leader. And then you discuss, of course, as much as you can. But then that person has to weigh all the ideas and make a quick decision. And that's the safety of the mountains. You just have to have someone you trust. So, yeah, some trust broke down on that trip. And but ultimately, you know, the good news is that these kids in Tibet are some of the most educated kids in Tibet. And they're now sending money back to their families. It's hard to be shunned and be a pariah when you're the one sending the money home to your family. And so Sabria, the blind teacher who started that project, in a dozen years sort of changed the whole reality of what disability looked like in this entire country. And I brought that idea home with me because I thought, yeah, these barriers look intractable and they're there for a reason and they've been there for a thousand years, but you can break through these things in a dozen years. It's possible.
We're speaking with Eric Weihenmayer and talking about his newest book called No Barriers, A Blind Man's Journey to Kayak the Grand Canyon. Earlier in the book, he talks about the experience of going blind as a young teenager, but then of managing to reach the summit of Mount Everest in 2001, the first and still only blind person to achieve that, and his most recent real-life adventure to kayak the Grand Canyon, 277 miles of the rapids of the Colorado River. Until I read your book, I did not stop to really ever think about how different these accomplishments were. That is, climbing a mountain and riding the wild waters of the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon are two completely different adventures, both incredibly dangerous, but dangerous and difficult and challenging for a blind person in completely different ways. Just explain a couple of the most significant ways in which this was an adventure like none other you had ever experienced.
Well, my friend taught me how to do a roll. You get knocked over a lot of times on a kayak, and so you got to roll back up with your paddle and get yourself upright. And so it launched 6 years of training for the Grand Canyon. And you know, at 40 years old, starting this new project, starting this new idea, like PV had said, you know, push forward into new terrain. And rivers were so utterly different, night and day from mountains. Mountains, you kind of have a little bit of control over your proximity. You know, you can stop and recollect, you know, collect yourself. Rivers, you can't do that. There's no brakes. And in fact, a lot of times you're not even fully in control. Yeah, you're sort of using the energy of the river to kind of get in position, but then there's no stopping. You just ride that energy at the river's pace and force, and it's like embracing chaos, like these, you know, forces that are so much bigger than you. And so I remember so many times along that journey just thinking, this is so hard starting over. At 40 years old, you just feel so vulnerable. Like, you know, Everest was supposed to teach me this great lesson and prepare me, and it didn't. I felt, you know, completely just laid out there.
Well, I mean, one would come off of Mount Everest in a sense feeling invincible, and you felt anything but invincible in this experience. And what's really quite striking is even before you get to the Colorado River, it's a harrowing experience just in terms of the training. For instance, just say a brief word about the National Whitewater Center and the kind of things that you did there and how important it was for you to return there at one point to rebuild your own confidence that had been so completely dashed.
Well, the crazy part is that I work with at No Barriers with a lot of people who get stuck, you know. You know, when it gets really severe, people call it PTSD, and you get stuck in your brain. And so I went off on a river, and it was a huge flood stage, and I got over my head, and I got so scared. I could hardly get back in my kayak. I'd lost my confidence. I'd lost my combat role. And I realized I couldn't get through it, so I had to kind of back up and start over and reprogram my brain, repattern my brain. And so I went to this incredible center in Charlotte, North Carolina, where you can, it's a man-made river. It's a concrete river, and they actually pour water down it with pumps and then pump the water back up. And they have all these features underneath the water, these barriers and drop-offs that create the rapids. And so you can go over and over and over down these things and map out the rapid and really focus on your technique. And by doing that, I kind of rebuilt myself.
And in the midst of this adventure involving the Grand Canyon and the Colorado River, you also spend some time in the book talking about adopting a son from Nepal. I think it's a really intriguing and wonderful choice that you make to include that in the book as you do, even though on the surface it seems to have nothing to do with this this latest undertaking. Tell us why it was so important to you to include this story in this book.
Well, I'm smiling right now because I'm so glad that you noticed that it wasn't random. You know, barriers are barriers, right? And we have different threads that run through our lives, and one of them is family. And when you get in your 40s, I have two beautiful kids. At the time, I had one beautiful kid, and we wanted to bring a boy home to bring into our family. And that adventure, those barriers were more complex than ever in a mountain or a river. It's just like the bureaucracy, when you read the book, it's like it's just the craziest thing in the world. Thank God I had my wife, who's very, very aggressive and can, you know, really think things through step by step, because we were in the middle of a civil war in Nepal, and adoptions had stopped, and so you're trying to, like, get to the right appointments, and you're walking through streets on fire, you know, burning tires, bricks on fire flying over your head, and you're like, AK-47s pointed everywhere, and you're like, I need to get to my embassy appointment. You mind if I step around your AK-47? So it was a wild adventure bringing this guy home.
And it's a story, of course, that ultimately ends happily, as does your wild, dangerous ride down the Colorado River, which, of course, we can follow in your book. One of my favorite...
I hope I'm not giving away anything, but the blind guy lives.
Lives to tell about it. One of my favorite lines in the book is this: I'd grown up with defined rules of what a blind person could and could not do, and I knew what that blanket felt like as it lowered down and began to suffocate you. My whole life, I'd been trying to break free of it and do something bold and unexpected. You have certainly done that time and time again, and we read about it in your wonderful new book called No Barriers, A Blind Man's Journey to Kayak the Grand Canyon, published by Thomas Dunn Books. Eric Weyenmeyer, I thank you so much for joining me and for talking about your marvelous book. And if people want to explore something about your program called No Barriers, where can they find more information?
Yeah, go to nobarriersusa.org, and you can read about all our programs. We have one coming up this summer in Squaw Creek, California. We'll have 1,000 people all celebrating the ways they break through barriers in their life.
Wonderful. Eric Weyenmeyer, thank you again for joining me today on The Morning Show. This was fun.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, something quite out of the ordinary. I'm going to be taken on a tour of one room of the downstairs of this building, the Inspire Center at Gateway Technical College. And I'm going to be shown an amazing piece of technology called the Anatomage Table 6, something that looks like it's straight out of science fiction, like sick bay on the USS Enterprise on Star Trek. It is a way in which students can explore the human body on this amazing screened table. And I look forward to taking a closer look at it tomorrow. And this is actually a morning show that you will either be able to listen to over the airwaves, as you normally do, or you'll be able to watch it on our Facebook page. There will be cameras there as well. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. Wednesday, a Carthage colleague, Eric Johnson, will join us to talk about the trade war with between the United States and China. On Thursday, the author of a book called Abandoned, which looks at what she believes to be a desperate disconnection that is occurring in many young people in our country. Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea. featuring unique shopping and the historic Jack's Cafe featuring an eclectic menu. A Kenosha tradition since 1911, modernized for a new age. Visit jackandrea.com for more information. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we remind you that the morning show is also available as a podcast 7 days a week, a different morning show.